Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana, recorded live at the club's monthly luncheon in downtown Indianapolis. This month's speaker is political analyst Bill Kristol. Kristol is the editor of the Weekly Standard, a columnist for the New York Times, and a commentator on Fox News Sunday. Kristol talks about next week's historic presidential election and why he supports John McCain and Sarah Palin.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. It'd be easier to talk about the election one week after Election Day. It's kind of a bad timing here. I'm going to make I'll avoid predictions so as not to make too much of a fool of myself. It's great to be back in Indianapolis. I spent a lot of time. First year, I think, in 1970 when I was a 17-year-old kid and came to the Indiana Purdue, flew here and then went down to Bloomington for the Indiana Purdue game. I had a good friend who then was a grad student at IU. And that was the first Big Ten football game I saw. I think Leroy Keyes was the star at that time of the Purdue team. This is really dating me, you know. Spent a lot of time here in Indianapolis from 89 to 92 when I was Dan Quayle's chief of staff. And I very much like this city and have a lot of friends out here. Al Hubbard, who was my deputy chief of staff, and then, of course, went on to be Bush's advisor, economic advisor in the White House. He's a very close friend. I know he's active in this club, I think. He's in Chicago today, he told me. I told him on the phone Friday that he had perfect time. He came to work for George Bush, President Bush, in, I think, January of 05, at the beginning of the second term, left about a year ago, like mid-late 2007. He was the president's economic advisor. On his watch, the economy grew. And timing is very important in politics and as in life. And he can say, well, the 2.5 years he was there in the White House, everything was fine. But he's a good friend. And I have bittersweet memories of Indianapolis, too, because it was here on election night in 92 at the Columbia Club that we learned, or at least it was confirmed, we expected it, that we were being booted out of the White House by the voters in November 92 and giving it over to Bill Clinton. But it was actually still, of all the things I've done, editing a magazine, writing columns for the Times, being on Fox, I do want to say, since I'm in Indianapolis and since Dan Quayle was a senator from Indiana, I was so fond of this city and state that still the greatest honor I had was being his chief of staff and trying to help him and help First President Bush. And I think we did actually a pretty good job in that administration. Not that the voters appreciated it in November 92, but occasionally the voters make mistakes, you know. Democracy's a... that's the most partisan thing I'll say about this election. Democracy's a great thing, but not every choice is correct, and sometimes the short-term and the long-term get confused. It's also really good to be here because this is one of the few cities I think you can visit, and you have a Republican mayor and a Republican governor. It's kind of become a rare thing, you know. But I grew up on the west side of Manhattan. Actually, as a kind of Scoop Jackson Democrat, we didn't have a lot of Republicans on the west side. Bella Abzug was my congresswoman. That's how I became a conservative. But I started off, as I say, as a Scoop Jackson Democrat. I went to Harvard in 72, began my very successful political career, which culminated in the 92 Bush-Quayle reelection. In 72, I worked for Scoop as an undergraduate at Harvard. The Massachusetts primary was then very important. It was right after New Hampshire. Remember, McGovern upset Muskie in New Hampshire, wide open race. We thought Scoop really had a chance. He was such a fine senator, really was, kind of Cold War liberal, really a man of integrity and courage. And we thought he had a chance, and I worked very hard for him, leafleting and, you know, sending out mailers and stuff as a 18, 19-year-old. Scoop ran seventh in the Massachusetts primary in 1972 behind Wilbur Mills. As I say, it was a very successful electoral career I've had. But anyway, to give you a sense of politics in Cambridge, it's a little different from Indianapolis, which is a nice balanced swing state, as we're now learning. Like Democratic senator, Republican senator, and all that. Cambridge, Massachusetts is a little different. I taught at the Kennedy School. I don't know if Steve mentioned that, from 1983 to 85, the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. I was the token conservative on the faculty there. They like to have one at all times. You know, it's useful for the students to know what one looks like, especially when they have to go out for a job interview or something like that. But in any case, we lived there from 83 to 85. We lived in the 8th Congressional. It was just outside Cambridge in Belmont, Massachusetts, in the 8th Congressional District of Massachusetts. It was Tip O'Neill's congressional district. He was Speaker of the House, a revered figure up in Boston, totally Democratic congressional district. And I remember voting in November 84, and I voted for Reagan for re-election to the presidency, and I voted for actually the Republican Senate candidate against John Kerry in Kerry's first Senate race. I'll interrupt the story to say that I saw Kerry about a year ago. He was doing Fox News Sunday. We were chatting in the green room, and he vaguely remembered I had a sort of Harvard connection and asked when I'd been up there, and we talked about it, and I said I was there when he first ran for the Senate, and I said, of course, I voted against you, Senator Kerry. And maybe you're not aware of this, but Senator Kerry doesn't have a great sense of humor. So he said, you voted against me? And I said, well, of course, I was a Reagan Republican. It was nothing personal, you know, and of course Kerry won the race by 10 points. Kerry sort of drew himself up and said, Bill, you know, my opponent was not really well qualified for the office. Gee, lighten up, Senator Kerry. In any case, I voted for against Kerry, and I voted for the opponent to Tip O'Neill, even though I knew it was a hopeless race. And I remember the next morning, my wife had the Boston Globe open to the election returns at breakfast, and I remember asking Susan, you know, just out of curiosity, how many votes — I knew Reagan had won, and I knew Kerry had won — how many votes did the Republican running against Tip O'Neill get? And Susan looked at the Globe and kind of looked again and said, I hate to tell you this, there was no Republican running against Tip O'Neill. And I said, you know, I know I voted for someone against Tip. It turned out I had voted for the communist. So this should make — if you ever get a little, you know, disillusioned about politics here in Indianapolis, you should be grateful you're not living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'll give you my sense of where we are politically, and then maybe step back and say a word about the broader environment, and then leave time for your questions. I mean, it's been a pretty amazing year. I would say the most important thing about 2008, if you just step back and say, you know, how do we get to where we are today with Obama and McCain as the nominees in a pretty close race, though Obama certainly with a lead a week before Election Day. It's the first race since 1952, first race in most of our adult lifetimes, when there's not an incumbent president on the ballot nor an incumbent vice president seeking to step up. That's been the norm for 56 years. And usually that gives a kind of structure to the race. You know, it's Bush running for re-election, it's Gore running to succeed Clinton, and usually that means that the election is a referendum on the administration in power. And you can usually figure out what's going to happen pretty easily, because you can tell if the country is doing well or doing badly. And if people want to throw Carter out, they'll throw him out, or throw Bush out in 92 in our case. Or if they want to re-elect the president, Reagan in 84, they'll do that. Or elect Bush in 88 as sort of Reagan's third term. But no incumbent this year. Wide open primaries in both parties, which we haven't had in a long, long time. And most interestingly, I think, upsets in both parties. You know, a lot of conventional wisdom is almost always wrong, I found, in politics, like in markets. You know, it pays to be contrarian, I think. And the conventional wisdom has settled in over the last 5-10 years. The front runner at the end of the year before the election year is going to win. The person who's raised the most money at the end of the year before the election year is going to win. American politics has become very hard for underdogs to make a difference. And, of course, that was true for a long time. You know, Bradley challenged Gore, but Gore won. McCain challenged Bush, but Bush won. Dole won in 96. You know, kind of the next person in line typically won. This year was a pretty amazing year, and I think a healthy year in a way. You know, Hillary Clinton was ahead of Obama by 15, 20 points at this time in 2007, this time a year ago. She had out-fundraised him. She had a much, what was thought to be, a better organization. She was going to be the kind of anointed next-in-line appointee. And she was upset, obviously, by Senator Obama, who ran a pretty fantastic campaign. Though, to her credit, she ran a pretty tough campaign, too. And ironically, and this is one of these cases where who would have predicted it, he won because he had a better organization than her and won these caucus states. She actually was almost able to catch him because she actually beat him as a candidate in a lot of states, including, I guess, in Indiana, ultimately, though that was awfully close. It's one of these great ironies that if you'd said a year ago, you know, say Obama's the exciting candidate and Clinton is the machine, but it turned out that Obama had the better campaign, and Clinton in some ways, when she actually got one-on-one with Obama in big states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, though outspent and outorganized, ended up beating him. In any case, we had an upset on the Democratic side. Long time since we've had that kind of upset. You know, long time since we've had a one-term senator, obviously, be nominated by a major party for president. by Carter in 76, we had the last time we've had such a sort of outsider win a major party nomination. McCain wasn't an outsider. He had won in 2000, obviously, and lost to Bush. But his campaign fell apart in the summer of 2007. And if you go back to go to Real Clear Politics website and just scroll back to the 2007 polls at this time, McCain is running third or fourth nationally in the polls, behind Romney, behind Giuliani, who was the front runner. We've all forgotten that. He was outraised by both Giuliani and Romney. Fred Thompson got in the race in September of 07 and was thought to have a real chance, and I think he might have had a real chance if he had decided to campaign a little more. Our second daughter worked, got out of college a year and a half ago from WashU in St. Louis, and actually got a job on the Fred Thompson campaign, and I once told her that I thought they had a very good candidate, but it wasn't clear that he was actually running a campaign, and that was a little demoralizing to her, since she was. You got to keep your kids on their toes, you know. You don't want them to get a overly high opinion of themselves. But she's moved on, thank God, to another job. It was a short-lived first job after college. Fred Thompson for president. Yeah. I told her at the time, this is a very good introduction. I didn't know how prophetic these words were. It would be, unfortunately, very good introduction to the job market. You know, you can't assume that you'll have jobs too long, and now that's looking a little too prescient. Anyway, Thompson got in the race. It was unclear what was going to happen, and McCain came back from third or fourth place to win the nomination. Never in modern American history have both parties' nomination been won by people who were trailing in December of the year before, in December 07, trailing in the polls and trailing in money. So we had upsets in both parties, which is pretty interesting, and I think indicative of the moment we're in, which is a very fluid moment in which a lot of the rules of the game that political types like me could cite, you know, this is always the way it works. The one thing about 2008 has been it's not working the way it's always worked, and I think that's true not just in politics, but in a sense in the world and certainly in the economy as well. It's really an unusual moment, and one of the biggest mistakes you can make, I think, analytically in a moment like this is to say, well, in the 15 or 20 years that we've been involved in something, you know, this is always the way it turns out, because, in fact, in this race, no one who had followed politics for the last 15, 20 years would have predicted an Obama-McCain race. Some of us did think that there was a chance for an upset in one or both parties. It turned out that way. Now we're a week from Election Day. Obama's obviously ahead by 5, 6, 7, 8 points nationally. It's a little hard, 9, 10. It's hard to tell. States like Indiana are in play. And I really don't know what's going to happen. I say the conventional wisdom in Washington is Obama wins easily. Probably it's a little like Reagan in 1980. The challenger, the people are very unhappy about the incumbent administration, fairly or unfairly. Bush is very unpopular. The country's on the wrong track. We've had this disastrous financial crisis. The markets are down 20% in October. In that environment, people want change. They want to vote for the out party. The Democrats, even though they won Congress almost 2 years ago, aren't blamed for the current policies. Bush has been president for 8 years. There's been a Republican Congress for 12 years until 2006. It looks like Republican policies brought this upon us, and people will vote for the out-party candidate if they can be reassured that that person is sort of up to the job. And in 80, when Reagan challenged Carter, people forget this now, Reagan was considered a sort of far-right wing, over-the-hill former actor who somehow had sort of luckily become governor of California but wasn't really suitable to be president. He had lost the challenge to Ford in 76. It took Reagan the whole campaign to convince voters that he was sort of up to the job. He wasn't going to blow the world up in his first week in office. He wasn't going to destroy the entire infrastructure of the federal government and, you know, kill the Food and Drug Administration or whatever the kind of, you know, scare stories were about Reagan. And, in fact, in the last week, especially after the last debate, the only debate of that campaign between Reagan and Carter, Reagan, who in what had been a close race, Reagan opened up to a 9-point victory, swept in a Republican Senate, which they hadn't been in a quarter century. Republicans picked up, I think, 26 House seats, and Reagan even had a working majority in the House, even though there was still a Democratic majority. That's kind of the Obama campaign's model for what should happen this year. And I would say many people in Washington think that could be what happens. Obama wins easily, wins states like Indiana, conceivably, that one would not have thought you could win a year out. Reagan won all kinds of states in 1980 that no one thought he could win. And sweeps in senators and congressmen and has, you know, a big moment for the Democratic Party, as 1980 was for Reagan and the Republican Party and the conservative movement. That's possible. That's possible. Obama did a good job in the debates of being reassuring, being calm. I think in the financial crisis, people like me criticized him because he didn't really get involved, but he was probably smart to keep a certain distance and seem cool and collected. He's been more moderate in his positions in the general election than he was in the primaries, and has walked back from some of the things that might alarm people. It's not so clear how quickly he's going to get out of Iraq. He sounds like he'll be tough on Iran. He's not for cutting the defense budget. Barney Frank said we have to cut the defense budget last week, and Obama said, no, that's not my position. So I think he's trying to reassure people that he'll be more moderate than his pretty liberal voting record might lead people to believe, and he may well win easily. I'm a little dubious. He's awfully inexperienced and awfully liberal for a major party presidential nominee. He probably is going to win, but it will be the first time a liberal Democratic senator has won since Kennedy, I guess. And even Kennedy, people forget this, ran as a moderate, kind of a hawk. Kennedy beat the left wing of the Democratic Party in 1960, which preferred Adlai Stevenson and even Hubert Humphrey. And so it's been a very long time since a real liberal Democrat was elected to national office. And one wonders whether at the end of the day there's still some resistance to that among voters who are intrigued by Obama, impressed by Obama, and want change. And I do think McCain, though he's run I think his campaign's not been great, is a very attractive Republican, and I could see McCain gaining in this last week. So if you ask me the most likely outcome, I would say the race closes some. Obama still wins. He wins by 4 points, not by 10 points. States like Indiana slide back towards McCain. The down-ticket damage or benefit, depending on your point of view, of the Obama victory is less than people now think. People like senators like Coleman in Minnesota, McConnell in Kentucky survive. Maybe the Democrats pick up 5 or 6 Senate seats, not 8 or 10. I think that, personally, I think that's the more likely outcome. Now, look, there's a week to go. 12-15% of the voters are either undecided or still loosely decided, have preferences, but they're not committed. And it's hard to predict. A lot depends on what happens in this last week and how the candidates seem in their closing arguments. But I'm struck in the primaries that each Obama was ahead and often did win, obviously, the primaries. But Hillary Clinton tended to get a disproportionate number of the late deciders. And the way one political scientist friend of mine put it is, if you weren't for Obama by now, after all the hoopla, all the excitement, all the rallies, all the crowds, are you really going to go to Obama at the end? Doesn't that show that you're sort of resisting the magic, so to speak? And isn't the easier default to the more experienced candidate, whether it's Hillary or McCain? And I think that's probably true. But, again, this is uncharted waters. We've never had a race like this. You can't take the normal models. There's no incumbent. How much is McCain ultimately blamed for Bush? How much do people say, I want to change and I'm just going to vote for Obama even though I've got qualms and worries? How much do people say, there's going to be a Democratic Congress anyway. Maybe I'll vote for McCain so we have some balance in Washington and we'll still get change. It's not like we're going to have the Bush administration there, but at least we have a Republican president to check the excesses of a Pelosi-Reid Congress. I think that's an argument the McCain campaign could have done a lot more with, actually. It's just hard to predict, honestly, which way the undecided voters go at the end. So my own gut instinct is, more like a 4-point race than a 10-point race. And I think there's a 1 in 6 chance, 1 in 8 chance that McCain actually wins a close race. People are understating how much voters can move in the last week. Gore, I looked this up last night, in the Gallup poll taken on the Monday before, 8 days before the election in 2000, Gore was down by 7 points to Bush. Gore ended up beating Bush in the popular vote by 0.5 point. McCain is down in the Gallup right now by about 7 points to Obama. It would be, it would be drawing to an inside straight for McCain to win this time. Everything would have to go his way. He'd have to get about 3/4 of the undecided voters. The Obama turnout machine would have to be overrated. All kinds of things. McCain would have to win a lot of states, narrowly. So it's a long shot. On the other hand, as McCain likes to point out, this year began with the Super Bowl in Arizona, in Phoenix, in which the Patriots were undefeated, the greatest team in football history. What were they, 16-point favorites over the Giants? And as I recall, I know this was the wrong Manning from your point of view, but the Giants won. Maybe I shouldn't mention football after some of your slight problems here in the first 6 weeks of this season. But you'll do fine tonight. Don't worry. And, you know, the Giants won with that amazing catch. I mean, you could have a sort of a squeaker McCain victory. I don't rule that out. I think it's a fluid year. I think this is not a case. Again, it's very important. When there's an incumbent president running for re-election, let's say Bush in 2004, people have watched him in office for 4 years by the time they vote. People have pretty much made up their mind. They like him or they don't like him. In Bush's case, it was a pretty closely divided judgment, and he won 51-48. But the amount of variability you're going to have, it's like Coke and Pepsi, you know. People have decided whether they prefer Coke or Pepsi, and it's unlikely that 10% of you in the next week are going to change your mind if you've been drinking Coke or Pepsi, 7-Up, for, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years as consumers. This is not Coke and Pepsi. This is sort of two, I don't know what the good business, the good business metaphor for this. This is two new products, relatively new products, which people are still testing. And people do change their preferences when they're not, you know, as established. They haven't been watching these guys in office. Neither's been president. No one on either ticket is in the current administration. Obama's been in the Senate 4 years. McCain's a kind of complicated maverick who's, you know, both admired by a lot of people and has annoyed a lot of people over the years. Palin is, of course, even more of a wild card than Obama in a sense. I think extremely talented political figure, mishandled, unfortunately, by the McCain campaign. But I would still say personally a benefit to the ticket. And I don't buy all this conventional wisdom in Washington that she's scaring off a lot of voters. And I think she's probably exciting a lot of voters. And there may be even a little bit of a kind of politically correct thing going on where people are scared to say that they actually admire and like Governor Palin. So I think she could draw some voters in at the end for McCain. So again, it's a very unusual, your first African-American, obviously, to run for president, second woman to run for vice president. Just you have to throw out a lot of the normal rules in thinking about this election. So I think it's more up in the air, less settled than people think. The range of outcomes is very great. You know, I would not be wildly surprised to see Obama win 53-45, and I wouldn't be that surprised to see McCain win 50-48. And that's a pretty big, you know, range just a week out, I think, for what could happen. And obviously, it's going to be a very interesting week to watch, and I think an interesting election night. What happens afterwards? Either way, I think both parties have very interesting choices to make. If Obama wins, the good news is he'll have a big Democratic majority in both houses of Congress. The bad news is he'll have a big Democratic majority in both houses of Congress. Bush had a nice Republican majority in 2005-2006. That laid the groundwork for the terrible, from a Republican point of view, midterm results in 2006 and what now looks like a tough election in 2008. Clinton had a nice Democratic majority in 2003 and 2004. They promptly lost both houses of Congress and didn't get them back for 12 years. I mean, it's tough to be put in charge of everything. You know, voters tend to hold you accountable for everything that goes wrong. They don't give you much credit for what goes right. You know, it's really true of Bush. I mean, partly it's Bush's fault. They've been so bad at their own communications and their own explanation of what they're doing. But, you know, leaving aside the recent financial crisis, the idea that Bush gets no credit at all for pretty good economy for 6 or 7 years, no attack after 9/11, tough time in Iraq, and a difficult, I think a poor prosecution of the war at first, but turning it around courageously with the surge, and now a perfectly satisfactory, actually, outcome in Iraq. You know, two good Supreme Court appointments from a conservative point of view, but even from a sort of moderate, I would say, you know, point of view in terms of their credentials and their qualifications. It's amazing that the whole country's just decided, even before the recent financial problems, the whole country just decided the Bush administration was a total fiasco and disaster. It does show that communication skills and explaining yourself are important. But it also shows that if you have united government, people just hold you accountable for everything that goes wrong, and you don't get much credit for what goes right. So Katrina is this horrible disaster, and that was somehow Bush's fault. The Medicare prescription drug benefit, to take the biggest piece of domestic legislation until the bailout of the Bush administration, which, you know, people, conservatives like me, weren't really crazy about. But you got to say it's worked pretty well, actually. It's a pretty good reform of Medicare. It's coming in under budget. It was Bush's biggest domestic policy initiative along with the tax cuts. But no one thinks about it. He gets no credit at all. Obama's not, incidentally, the Democrats voted against it. They're not going to repeal it. Obama's not critical of it, you know. But somehow Bush gets no credit. Anyway, it's just a long way of saying that it's tough to have both the presidency and both houses of Congress. And Obama in particular is going to have a tough time resisting the pent-up demand of Democratic and liberal interest groups. Now, I think he'll have a good excuse to resist, which will be in a pretty bad recession, I'm afraid, by January 20th. And it's hard to believe that in a recession what you want to do is cut back on trade or pass protectionist measures or make it that much easier to unionize small businesses or raise taxes on small businesses, but or do kind of cap-and-trade ambitious global warming schemes, which would really hamper, I think, U.S. competitiveness. We'll see what Obama can do with Pelosi and Reid. Anyway, very interesting, I think, for the Democratic Party. They could succeed. I mean, this could be a huge moment for them. If Obama were to govern successfully, if he were to inherit a recession, take us out of it, restrain the left wing of the Democratic Party, make the Democratic Party look like a responsible, centrist governing institution, by contrast with those inept Bush people, which is certainly what they would sort of say, it could be an FDR, Franklin Roosevelt-like moment, where Obama, and this is certainly what Democrats hope, where Obama sort of lays the groundwork for 10, 20 years of Democratic Party dominance and control, reestablishes the good name of liberalism after the mistakes of the late 60s and of Carter and of and the excesses of the left in the 80s and 90s. Or it could be like 93, 94, where they promptly lose, you know, the one or both houses back in 2010. It could be like 76, 80, when Carter had a Democratic Congress. Or 2005, 2006, when Bush had a Republican Congress, and they end up looking on, you know, being unpopular and not succeeding. So a very important moment if Obama wins. Obviously, if McCain wins, a very interesting moment of bipartisan leadership in Washington. It could be an interesting moment because I think it could break through some of the partisanship of the last few years. I think people are ready for a change from the bitter partisanship. McCain has a history of that. I think you could see a lot of interesting legislation. But then there would be fights both, can you imagine if Obama lost? I mean, what the mood in the Democratic Party would be, it would be kind of amazing. I mean, after everything they've gone through this year, after all the expectations, my colleagues at the, on the New York Times op-ed page, their heads would explode. You know, there'd be a blank page for 2 or 3 weeks after the election. Might be a good thing, but it would be the best. Honestly, I think personally, of course, I'm for McCain. I think he'd be a better president and policies that I agree with more. But the single best reason, in my view now, to root for McCain is just the total hysterical meltdown it would ensure on in Georgetown and on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and in Hollywood. You know, half the actors and actresses would leave the country. You know, be pretty fantastic. So I think, I mean, if McCain wins, in other words, the Democratic Party and liberalism will have a huge kind of rethinking, you know, crisis of confidence. But if McCain wins, the Republican Party will still be debating its own future, because McCain probably would be a one-term president. I kind of think in the back of his mind, he probably thinks he would try to serve one term and hand it over, let the voters decide who would succeed him. There'd be a lot of debates about the conservative future, the Republican future. Certainly if McCain loses, I think everything is up for grabs in the Republican Party. The one thing I learned in 93, 94, after the voters threw us out when I was in the Bush-Quayle administration, is things change more than you expect when you lose both the presidency and Congress. I mean, Bush has been president for 8 years. There was a Republican Congress for the 6 years before that. Republicans in Washington, too much so, I think, have become very used to a certain kind of hierarchical structure, various authority figures kind of in the party. That all goes out the window the moment the voters throw you out. And I think it's really a moment of opportunity for younger House members, Senate members, governors like Mitch Daniels or Sarah Palin or Bobby Jindal to say, wait a second, here's a new, fresh agenda for the Republican Party. I think there's just much more turnover and turmoil than people are, than we're used to, than the Republicans are used to. And look at the Democrats. They lost everything in 04. They had great hopes. People forget this. In early 04, Kerry was, you know, Kerry Bush was very unpopular. The war was going badly. Kerry was ahead in the polls as late as mid-September of 04. The shock of losing the presidency and losing houses in the Senate and losing seats in the Senate and the House. 4 years later, Obama's the Democratic nominee. And that's, you know, a guy who was elected first in 04. This time, 4 years ago, Barack Obama was a state senator from Hyde Park in Chicago, running for the Senate in Illinois. That's what can happen when a party's out of power and is really open to fresh faces, and to some degree, I would say, to fresh ideas. And I think that could happen on the Republican side if Republicans lose everything this year. So I think the next few years are likely to be as tumultuous as the last year. That's the one piece of advice I would give you if you're thinking about politics. I think things are much more up in the air than we're used to in terms of politics, in terms of policy. And I'll just briefly touch on policy. I mean, we're clearly at a new moment in terms of the financial institutions. That's all going to have to be reconfigured. It can be done in a million different ways. I think conservatives have to think creatively about what role government should play, and I think it obviously has important roles to play in terms of banks and financial institutions, but how you prevent that from being, you know, a government takeover, in effect, of the entire financial industry. The left, of course, is sort of, you know, cheerfully looking forward to much more government control of the commanding heights of the economy. That debate will be interesting within both parties and between the two parties over the next few years. Healthcare, lots of domestic policy issues, I think are much more fluid. I mean, I think the biggest mistake one can make analytically is to assume, well, these issues have been gridlocked for the last several years, so they're going to stay gridlocked for the next few. I don't buy that. I mean, it really will be a new moment. Voters are open, for better or worse, to pretty big changes. And so I think there'll be big debates within both parties and within among conservatives and among liberals on lots of these issues. The world post 9/11 is very volatile, dangerous, fluid. Great opportunities, I think, as well. And again, look at Iraq, if you want an instance of how fast things can change. A war that at first had bipartisan support and looked, frankly, like it was going to be easy, then became very partisan, still looked like it wasn't going to be that bad, but certainly the left was very, very much opposed by November 04, then looked horrible and was horrible by November 06 and lost majority support, and we were losing the war, honestly. And then Bush goes for the surge, which is unpopular, and manages to hang on, thanks to McCain in large part. Hang on to enough support to sustain it. And Petraeus and Odierno pull off a pretty amazing turnaround in just a year. You know, well, wars are very unpredictable. Momentum matters a lot. And I think the same will be true in general in foreign policy. Some of the things that we probably are most worried about today, we won't be worried about 4 years ago, and other things that we haven't thought much about, we could be very worried about. So a very fluid world, challenging world, very fluid domestic scene. A lot of the old economic certainties seem to be gone. Possibly an Obama administration or a McCain administration, neither of which we have much of a model for. You know, if you think about recent administrations, it's really an uncertain and fluid and unpredictable moment. And I think that's okay. I mean, that's what... You know, politics would be boring and our national life would be boring if everything just went along in a predictable way. Sometimes when the stock market's been down 20% in a month, you'd like a little predictability and you wouldn't mind turning the clock back, but that's not how the world works. And I think in a democracy like ours, in a way, it's an exciting time to be involved in public life, as so many of you are, or civic life, or the public debates and economic debates, because things really are more susceptible to being shaped by the citizenry and by leaders than sometimes. Sometimes you're kind of on a certain path and you just kind of chug along that path. That's not the moment we're on now. Final point, I would say this. I'm very, Rabbi Beanstalk sort of alluded to this. I mean, I'm quite optimistic, really, about the country, and I'm not just saying this because you're supposed to say this kind of thing. There have been other times in the past when I wasn't so optimistic. And the thing that made me most optimistic, actually, was the one trip I took to Iraq in the summer of 2007. And the surge was beginning to work. It was the last week of July, very hot in Baghdad in 2007. And it was beginning to work, and I had the sense then that we might pull out of this okay. And that was a great relief, obviously, and very inspiring to see what Petraeus and Odierno were doing and to see an impressive example of taking charge and turning a situation around. But also what was most inspiring really was seeing the young men and women who were serving, and particularly, I've got to say, I mean, all of them, from enlisted men all the way up through the current lieutenant colonels and colonels and the generals, but I'd say particularly the young officers and the sergeants, the lieutenants, the captains who were in command of platoons or companies. I mean, the degree of difficulty of what they were doing. I mean, it's one thing that I didn't serve, so I mean, already just, you know, obviously fighting a war against really vicious and difficult enemy is tough enough. But the kind of diplomacy they were engaged in with the local sheikhs or the local tribal leaders, the economic development they were doing, the humanitarian stuff they were doing for the people of Iraq and the kids. I mean, juggling all these things, if you're a 26-year-old lieutenant or a 30-year-old captain, I mean, it was really just unbelievable to ride around with them. And of course, worrying all the time about IEDs and about snipers and ambushes. I mean, it was a pretty amazing thing to see. And these kids, and, you know, from my point of view, they were kids. Obviously, they're adults. But it was really remarkable. And I thought, you know, conservatives like me in particular worry about the education system and the popular culture and all our kids are doing these days are playing video games and, you know, God knows what the next generation is going to be like. But actually, I got to say, seeing these young men and women in incredible positions of responsibility and with real consequences for the decisions they made, really reassured me about the future of the country. And I think one thing to watch over the next several years is as this generation of Iraq and Afghanistan vets comes home, some of them already are coming out if they want to serve one tour or two tours, and take positions of leadership in civic life, in economic life, in public life, in politics as well. I think they will take positions of leadership because I think people genuinely respect them. They chose to serve. They weren't drafted. Not that there's anything wrong with being drafted, but this is a volunteer army. They chose to serve. They served with amazing success and courage, and the country owes them a lot. And I think they'll be – it very much reassured me, honestly, about the future of the country. So whatever happens a week from now, some of us will be happy. Some of us will be a little disappointed, but I think we'll I think we'll be fine. Thank you.
Mr. Crystal has agreed to do some Q&A, and we have plenty of questions up here. So start off, you mentioned Sarah Palin, and we have a handful here about the vice presidential nominee. You were one of the first to identify her, and what is it about Sarah Palin that gives you the highest confidence that she would succeed as vice president? And following that up, do you still think that picking Sarah Palin was right for the ticket?
I mean, I worked for Dan Quayle, who got a totally bum rap from the media, so I did learn there to discount a lot of the public perceptions. And I think in Palin's case, I met her in July, I guess, of 07, a little over a year ago. We have these Weekly Standard went on a cruise. We do these cruises for our subscribers. They just pay the normal cruise, you know, fee and then a little additional. And we have seminars and dinners with them and all this. And we've done a couple in the Caribbean, and we did one to Alaska. Actually, you leave from Seattle and you go up the Inland Passage. I recommend it if you're looking for a cruise and in the summer, not in the winter, I think. And Governor Palin heard that we were coming, I guess, and invited Fred Barnes and his wife and Susan and me and actually our daughter who was with us to her modest governor's residence in Juneau for lunch. And that's where I met her, actually. So I think we spent a fair amount of time together that afternoon since, even though she was a hardworking governor of Alaska, her schedule didn't seem to be quite as busy as that of the governor of New York or, you know, or California or maybe or Indiana, I'm sure. I got to know her a little bit then and stayed in touch with her a bit and her staff. She's very impressive. She has a real natural political gift. She's smart. She's very smart, shrewd. She's not as educated, perhaps, as some, you know, public officials who went to fancy law schools or business schools. On the other hand, with all due respect to President Bush, after his presidency, I'm not sure that having Harvard Business School as a credential is going to be quite as good as it once was. And frankly, after the Wall Street fiasco over the last few months, I'm not so sure that people should look, you know, that all these fancy business school and law school graduates who invented mortgage-backed securities and sieves and all kinds of derivatives, maybe they shouldn't look down their nose so much at people who went to state school and worked their way up and were a little dubious that this was actually the way we should organize our financial system. So anyway, I've been a fan of hers. I think she's smart. I think she was thrown in pretty deep water pretty suddenly, obviously, and I think not treated well by the staff, which was too protective. I mean, they should have just let her go out and do her thing. She's an extremely good natural politician. And of course, she doesn't know as much about the details of foreign policy right now as Joe Biden, but she has plenty of time to learn, and she's going to be vice president, not president. And if, God forbid, something should happen to McCain, she would take over an administration with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense and a whole structure. It's not as if she has to invent, you know, what our policy is going to be towards the world. And I think this would be perfectly understandable to the American public that she is qualified to be vice president. She's a quick study and will be qualified if she should have to become president. And I think she'll be fine politically. I mean, she's taken some hits. The media is totally invested now in the narrative that she's a drag on the ticket. There's no empirical evidence for it. The best moment of the McCain ticket, the one moment in this campaign he's been ahead, was in the 2 weeks after the Republican convention. What was the most startling thing that happened at the Republican convention? It was Sarah Palin's pick and her speech and the immediate press conferences right after. So I think she remains a benefit. If you look actually at the polls, her numbers aren't bad. They're sort of 50-50 in terms of approval, disapproval. If McCain loses, she'll go back to Alaska and I think be a successful governor. And I do think governors are the place where policy can be made. She's been an energetic reformer. She's got a nice populist streak, and I'm not sure she'll run in 2012 or, you know, for national office, but I think she has a future. I do think we should market the fact that these weekly standard cruises, you know, resulted in my promoting her and Fred Barnes writing an article about her, and suddenly she's the VP nominee. We have this back page of the magazine, which is a parody page, and the page this year is letters from other governors to the Weekly Standard inviting them to do cruises in their states. You know, the governor of Utah saying that, you know, you may not know this, but the Great Salt Lake is a wonderful place for cruises. And we should have done one for Mitch Daniels, actually. You know, right? You know, come to Indianapolis. And but Mitch does not need to be discovered now. And seriously, I think I'm impressed by her. And I think, again, that it's amazing that I would say this. Obama and Palin are two of the most gifted natural politicians I've seen in the more than 20 years I've been in Washington. I saw Reagan. Obviously, he was already president, so that was different. But, you know, when you think about, I mean, she obviously just has this fantastic, people just sometimes have a knack for connecting with people, for seeing kind of what really matters to people. The main thing I blame the McCain campaign for is, as I say, putting her under wraps. She gave a fantastic speech on Friday on special needs kids, which she obviously has a personal interest in now. And it was a very interesting substantive speech, but also quite moving in terms she talked about what this, you know, how to think about such kids and how they're a gift and a blessing, not a burden, but we have to, as a society, have to make it easier for parents to and families to deal with the, you know, what are practical challenges with these kids. This is a speech she wanted to give right after the convention. You know, she asked the McCain team, she said, let me give the, you know, she mentioned it, you may remember this in her convention acceptance speeches, she wanted to be a special advocate for special needs kids given her circumstances and her, you know, what she's learning about it and how. And she wanted to give a speech a week or two later, and the McCain people, you know, no, confusing, you can't do it before the debates, you have to study up for these interviews. And so instead, she, you know, by the time she gave it on Friday, it was kind of, it got no coverage at all, and it was swamped by this ridiculous clothing story, which itself, I'm sorry to go on so long, but I'm so angry about the way they've treated her. I mean, this clothing store is your class. I mean, she, you know, no one even knows that she didn't go to, Sarah Palin did not sit there in Minneapolis and say, gee, I'd like to go to Neiman Marcus and get some clothes, you know. She sat in her hotel room. They told her, you're going to need some additional clothes. We'll go get some for you. We'll get a shopper from one of these places to come and fit you and all this stuff. And so these people show up and they give her all these clothes. She rejects a lot of them. She takes a few. She says, okay, fine. She didn't know what store they were from. She certainly didn't know how much they were cost. She didn't decide that this is the way things had to happen. She hasn't worn most of them. And now she's embarrassed, and this is something no one's ever accused, whatever people think, she was a good pick or a bad pick, she's, you know, up to the job or not. No one ever accused her of, you know, living high off the hog or shopping at Neiman Marcus. I imagine she'd never set foot in a Neiman Marcus, and still hasn't, actually. So it was a typical kind of campaign staff chaos screw up. This is what happens, you know. But what most annoyed me, and I've been there as a staffer, the moment that story came out, the right thing for some staffer to do was to say, you know what, is to step forward and go before the press and say, this was my mistake. Governor Palin didn't tell anyone to go to Neiman Marcus. She said, we told her she would need some additional clothes and it was appropriate for the campaign to do that. And she said, okay. And she didn't know how much they cost. And she said, in fact, if anything, I'm told she sort of rejected them as being sort of fancy, but, you know, she took a few of them, obviously, and to use. And it was my fault, the staffer should have said, and should have taken the hit for it. And it would have been appropriate, this would have been truthful in this case. And that's what staff are for, you know, to take the hit. And instead, they just all kind of went into hiding. And really, half the public now thinks that Sarah Palin personally said, go get me some fancy clothes at Neiman Marcus, which is just really unfair. So in that respect, I am sort of annoyed at the McCain campaign. But you know what? The good news about these little things is I think they usually pass by. And she'll be either vice president or governor, and she'll prove herself in office. So I think she has a bright future.
In addition to that, and you've been critical of the campaign, what would you say, where did they go wrong?
Well, to be fair to the campaign, if you said, look, Bush is going to be at 23% approval, the country's going to have 10% of the public think we're on the right track, and Bush has been president for 8 years, and voters tend to like to change things after 8 years anyway. Only once since World War II have we elected a party for the third straight term. And Obama would be this very impressive, charismatic candidate who would gin up amazing enthusiasm and turnout among the Democrats. If you said all that ahead of time, you'd probably say, well, gee, it's going to be a tough year. So I don't want to be too critical of the campaign. I think they were playing a tough hand. I do think they overmanaged McCain as well as Palin. I mean, McCain is a very attractive and impressive guy. He's got limitations and deficiencies, and maybe ultimately he wouldn't have won even if they just let him be himself. But he has a pretty good track record in politics, you know. And I do think they've sort of diminished him a little bit. And people have forgotten how much they admired him and what he's done that's been admirable, both obviously as a you know, in the service of the country, in his military service, but also since then. And I don't think, but I think voters will come back to that a little bit at the end, which is why I do think McCain, Palin have a chance. I mean, the good news about our politics, for all the grumbling, is McCain, Obama, Palin, even Biden, maybe. I can't quite go that far, but are impressive people, actually. I mean, Biden's impressive in his own way. He's a nice guy. And he did overcome a terrible personal tragedy when he was first elected to the Senate. And he's a decent person and wants to do the right thing. Talks a little bit too much, but it'll be great having him as vice president. That's another thing to look forward to in an Obama administration is, you know, the private meetings in the Oval Office, and Obama's scheduled half an hour, and there are 8 people in there, and Biden is the vice president, has a certain standing, so he probably gets to go first ahead of the cabinet secretary, so Biden takes up 27 of the 30 minutes, and the secretary of state's looking at his, you know, Dick Lugar, secretary of state's looking at his watch. Hey, do I get to say anything here? No, sorry, you know. That'll be an enjoyable part of the Obama administration. Anyway, they're all, they're impressive people, the truth is. You know, McCain, Obama, Palin, Biden, I mean, they're not people to be embarrassed about having to choose between, I think, whether you agree or disagree with them. And so my main criticism of the McCain campaign is they've sort of made him a more conventional candidate than he had to be.
Last question. And there's many of them here about some of the recent last couple of weeks, accusations about wealth redistribution, socialists. Even, I guess, this morning they're talking about some comment about Marxism. Could you just kind of give us your perspective on that?
I mean, look, I don't – Obama was obviously, as a college student and as a young man, was way on the left and consorted with some people that I think is a legitimate issue. I mean, you know, Bill Ayers is apparently something in between a random acquaintance and a close friend of Obama's, and if people want to hold that against Obama, and I would to some degree, I think that's legitimate for McCain to raise. It's not McCarthyism. It's not inappropriate. On the other hand, the McCain campaign, and I think the same is true of some of his other associations, and he actually is he has a very liberal voting record in the U.S. Senate. National Journal, which is not a conservative magazine, rated him the most liberal senator on their just kind of objective tally of votes. He voted against Roberts and Alito. He voted against all the Bush economic tax cuts. He voted for the Democratic budgets that would have had tax increases, et cetera, et cetera. He's very liberal on social issues and the like. So I think it's perfectly fair to say that Obama's on the left wing of the Democratic Party. Part of that left, what that left wing believes is some form of redistribution of wealth. I don't think it's quite credible to say that he's sort of a Marxist socialist or that he's going to, but what he's running on is raising marginal taxes on the wealthy, raising taxes on capital gains and dividends, and it's certainly legitimate to say is that what we need in this economy, especially as we're in a recession. I do think the way the McCain campaign has raised these issues, it seems so episodic and sort of unsustained. And a little, if you're going to make an issue of his background and the people he's hung out with and make that issue in a serious way, but the kind of scattershot charges and, Joe the Plumber's here and someone else is there, and I mean, I like Joe the Plumber, and I think that was a useful way of maybe encapsulating the issue. But as a friend of mine said to me, Joe the Plumber did a better job of exposing Obama's economic plan than the McCain campaign had done for 2 months, I mean, that's a big tribute to Joe the Plumber, and I wish him well in his congressional race in 2010, but he is thinking of running for Congress, this is a great country, it is kind of an indictment of the McCain campaign. I do think it's interesting how, I'll just close on this, so I think it's a legitimate issue. And I think what's most revealing is the way the liberal media has treated Joe the Plumber in two ways. One, the character assassination of him, which really is a disgrace. And the guy asks Obama, Obama comes to his house. You realize this? I mean, he didn't, like, go out looking for this. He's playing catch in his front yard with this 13-year-old kid, as I understand it, a football catch. And Obama's doing kind of, you know, 20 minutes of door-to-door canvassing for the TV cameras. And he comes to Joe the Plumber's house in Ohio. So, you know, Joe takes the opportunity to ask him a question. And for this, he's vilified. And they're looking into his tax returns and, you know, his divorce records. I mean, it's really terrible. And that is partly the media and partly some of the left-wing opposition research groups, which are really bad. The second thing, though, is the way in which the media thinks they've answered Joe the Plumber's question is, well, he's how stupid he is. You know, he's making whatever he's making, $80,000 a year, $60,000 a year, and so he would get a tax break, allegedly, under Obama. In any case, the tax hike above 200 or 250 wouldn't hit him, which is very revealing of the left's mindset, which is you are in whatever category you're in, and you should be grateful to the government if it helps you out a little bit in that category, if it gives you a little more. And the notion, which actually Joe was saying, is that I don't want to stay at this income level. I would like to think about buying this business, and I would like to try to do better. And if I do better, aren't you going to penalize me and make it harder? I mean, in a way, he was making a much less selfish point than the media is presenting. He was trying to make a general argument about, you know, how will this threaten upward mobility and ambition and entrepreneurship, of which he hopes to be an example. And the media just doesn't understand that. And it struck me that, again, if McCain could have developed that theme a little better and made himself the – it's, I mean, it's not that Obama wants to punish, you know, Joe the Plumber. He just doesn't understand in a way that the tax code and regulatory codes have to make it easier for people to start businesses and grow businesses and all that. I think he could have been more effective in making these kinds of economic points. But, you know, these campaigns are complicated and chaotic, and it's easy for me on the outside to blame, as I say, the McCain campaign. I was part of the Bush Quail campaign in 92, which was not a great effort either. So, you know, I always say we were the guys who ran as the incumbents. Bush had gotten 55% of the vote, I think, in 88. We went to 38% in 92, one of the greatest drops in American history of an incumbent presidency, and I was part of that. And we were so bad that 19 million Americans voted for Ross Perot in 1992, and he's crazy. So that was my political achievement. Thank you.
That was William Kristol. Kristol is a regular commentator on Fox News Sunday. He's a columnist for the New York Times and an editor of the Weekly Standard. Matt Tully is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star. Tully says this election could challenge some long-standing political assumptions about Indiana. He says the state may be leaning Democratic for the first time in decades.
Well, a couple things. One, you know, our economy has been struggling for a long time. You know, the rest of the country kind of caught up with us in the last couple of years, but our manufacturing base has been hurting for a long time. So I think if you look back at past elections, 2007, we tossed out our incumbent mayor in Indianapolis. 2006, we tossed out three incumbent members of Congress. 2004, we tossed out our incumbent governor. Voters in Indiana have been kind of anxious or upset and acting it out at the polls for quite some time now. So it's not a big surprise to see that the party, the Democrats, who haven't played very well in the presidential campaign, doing well here. I think it's just another sign that Hoosier voters are anxious and worried about things and are willing to listen to candidates that maybe in the past they wouldn't have listened to.
That was Indianapolis Star columnist Matt Tully. You've been listening to an Indiana Public Broadcasting production of the Economic Club of Indiana. Next month's speaker is the CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, Charles Evans. He'll address the club on November 21st. Thanks for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.